Welcome to the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 106, where CJ and Andrew are going to talk about Docker and containers, recorded live December the 2nd, 2015.
Welcome to the Microsoft Cloud Show, the only place to stay up to date on everything going on in the Microsoft Cloud world, including Windows Azure, Office 365, SharePoint, Exchange, Link, and related technologies. Just the information, no marketing, no BS. I'm Andrew Connell.
And I'm Chris Johnson.
And we're just two dudes telling you how we see it.
Good day, CJ. How are you today?
Pretty sweet.
Pretty sweet.
Pretty sweet.
What's so sweet about today?
I don't know. It's a good day. The lake is flat and shiny. It's not too cold. And we're going to talk about Docker.
I see sun, too. That's odd.
It's my favorite new thing.
Sun or Docker?
Docker.
Well, you live in Seattle, so I thought that might be true. I might have nailed it.
Yeah, I'm going to Mexico next week, so there should be plenty of sun.
Ah, very cool. Very cool.
Well, when I say I should be going to Mexico next week.
Oh, yeah. Let's fill everybody in on what's going on. This is actually somewhat comical.
I may have had like the biggest travel faux pas known to man. And you know when you travel a bunch, you just sort of start treating it as very blasé and sort of, you know, you don't really think about it too much. Well, I didn't think about my passport too much. Mm-hmm. And turns out it expired in October.
Uh-oh.
And I'm not an American.
Ah, that's right. You're an invader.
Exactly. So my passport is currently somewhere over the Pacific, probably landing in New Zealand right about now. Well, the paperwork for a new one anyway.
Huh.
So I have got to get a new passport by Monday so that a friend of mine in New Zealand can pick it up and bring it over to the States for me.
Oh my goodness. So let's make sure. So just for the listener, just to get a sense of like context here, we're recording this on Wednesday, December the 2nd. Paperwork is showing up in New Zealand, likely today.
Yep.
They're making a new passport for you, an updated one, Thursday and Friday, December 3rd and 4th. And then you're supposed to be leaving for Mexico on Monday.
Well, just remember, New Zealand's a day ahead. So it's Wednesday now, but it's really Thursday there.
Ah, gotcha. Okay. So
they'll be making it on Friday.
Yeah, so they'll be making it on Friday. And then you're supposed to be flying to Mexico on Monday, but a friend coming from New Zealand is going to pick your passport up.
Yep.
And is going to meet you. You guys are happen to be flying on the same connecting flight out of Los Angeles down to Mexico. And you should be picking up your passport before you leave the U.S. in Los Angeles.
That's right.
You got a pucker factor going on at all here?
Major.
Is the wife a little pissed?
If she's pissed, she's hiding it very well. I think she's more nervous than pissed. And the reason I say that is normally she is the most planned person out there, and she also had a bit of a travel faux pas in that our daughter's passport also expired.
Oh, but she's an American.
But she's an American, so my wife is picking up Kate, my daughter's passport, this morning from the U.S. passport office in Seattle.
Oh my goodness,
a new one. Yeah,
man. So this will be this could be interesting. So we may end up. I guess the plan right now is to potentially take a week off next week, since you're going to be in Mexico. But we may end up recording next week if the passports don't flow the right way, huh?
Stop it. We're going to joke about these things. I don't want to. So I'm going to Mexico for my 40th birthday.
Man, you're old.
My wife and kids will be there, but it's debatable whether I will be.
Well, if you need a place to stay, hey, it's warm and we got sun here and we have beaches. So you can always come to Florida while the passport's still getting taken care of.
Yeah, sure. Except now you can't fly without a U.S. federally issued ID, and driver's licenses don't count. And my passport's expired.
Wait a minute. So how are you going to fly from Seattle to Los Angeles?
I'm going to blag my way.
You're going to blag your way?
Blag my way.
All right.
No, I'm actually going to use – I shouldn't say that give all the idea that I'm going to try and get one up on the TSA. No, I have a global entry card, which qualifies as a federally issued ID. So I should be fine on that.
Wow. That's interesting. When did that start? Because I've still been using my driver's license even as recently as like 2 weeks ago.
I think they're bringing it in the last couple of months at certain airports. It's going to be the rule, I think, starting next year. I think you're not going to be able to travel with a driver's license anymore.
Oh, interesting. Didn't know that.
Maybe an enhanced driver's license, I think, which is one with a chip in it. But anyway.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
You got a fun little adventure going on this weekend then. So good luck to you. I hope it all works out.
Thanks, man. Puck effect high.
Yeah, puckering so fast it's whistling, huh?
yeah, kind of.
I tell you what, for all the listeners, there's a little as a Facebook Messenger thread going back and forth. And I remember when this started, you were trying to investigate what are the different options available and what could you do and stuff. And it was just, I sat down to watch football. It was either one night or one day over the weekend.
Yeah, it would have been Sunday.
Yeah, Sunday. And I sat down to watch football. And then I was like, and I see this message come across and you're like, do you have a Federal Express account ID that I can use because I need to FedEx something and they'll only do it for an account holder? I'm like, whoa, that doesn't sound good. Let me go book on my laptop real quick.
Yeah, so it turns out if you ever want to send anything in the world to anywhere else in the world, you can get it on the next flight to that destination with FedEx. But it's going to cost from Seattle to New Zealand about $700 US.
That's not fun.
No.
Okay. So, hey, let's do the only update that I've got, I'm loving the Surface Pro. That's my only real like news.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you one thing, man, I love the device. Absolutely love it. There is one thing that is really freaking annoying. And apparently it's not just me. It's a lot of people. I hate to say it this way, but it looks like Microsoft totally screwed up this launch. The Surface Pro 4 and the Surface Book both have this problem. There's a display driver issue where sometimes the driver just crashes, and then sometimes you have to reboot to get things to work. The problem with mine, though, the experience that I have, and yes, before anybody asks, I've got the November 18th patches and all that kind of stuff done, as well as the manually downloadable drivers. When I go to use it, so either unfolding the keyboard, so it's kind of like classic unfold, it should wake up, or touching a key or moving a mouse or touching the power button, it does not wake up. The keyboard lights up, the backlight lights up, but the actual device does not light up.
And nobody's at home.
No, the screen never comes back. And the only way I can fix it is by doing a hard reboot. So you got to hold the power button down for 30 seconds. And it now happens about 3 out of every 5 times I go to use the device. So you are generally looking at about anywhere from a 90 second to almost a, 120 to 150 second startup every time you want to use the device. And for someone,
ouch.
Yeah, for someone that's used to using a MacBook Pro, where you open it up, even after it's been asleep for 4 days and it just pops right open, it turns on immediately. It's a pain in the ass.
Yeah. That's obviously not by design.
No. I've been going back and forth with Surface support on Twitter. And the thread they keep pointing you to, you see that the engineers are like, this is an extremely urgent issue we are trying to resolve. So,
yeah. Okay. They've got some driver problem.
Yeah. It sucks.
That sucks.
Still love the device.
Sounds like there's light at the end of the tunnel anyway.
Yeah. I do wish that there was, I wish Apple would come out with a device just like this, but with OS X on it and not iOS.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about the iPad Pro. I love the form factor of the Surface. Microsoft has nailed it.
It's good size.
Yeah.
Hey, so what are we talking about today?
You want to do tiny little bits of news real quick, and then we jump onto Docker?
Yeah, sounds good.
All right, rapid news real quick. So first one is Microsoft announced a new pricing plan for Office 365. They replaced the E4 license with an E5 license. This is a bit of a price increase as well. It jumps up to being a cost of about $420 per user per year. And the big things that you get from it from the previous plan of the E4 is you get what's called PSTN conferencing and calling, and you also get a cloud PBX. So basically now, if you are familiar with it in the past, you could use this thing called Link to Phone, where you can actually have a physical real like telephone number tied to your account, and you can call in and call out from Link, from Skype for Business.
So it's kind of the equivalent of Skype in and out in the consumer service, but being brought across to Skype for Business.
Yeah. And it's got some really cool features to it. I mean, I've been on the preview for it for a couple months. I just filed my paperwork, or not paperwork, I just filed my request and it's been approved. It just needs to go through to port my number from Skype consumer over to Skype for Business. The pricing for me was about the same, where Skype did not do a number forwarding or number porting. So I had to sign up for one service to forward my number to my Skype end number. And I was paying about $20 a month for that. Now with this new phone service and Skype for Business, I think it comes out to like $20 or $25 on top of my E3 license that I already had. And Before anybody says, yeah, why don't you just go get an E5? It's only $35. I get it. But with E3, I pay nothing for an E3 due to a little perk that I have from something. So
gotcha.
I'm only paying $20 for it. So
nice.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I think it's going to be what's really strange is like Microsoft is pitching this as for enterprises, like big enterprises. And I think the real sweet spot for this is going to be SMBs.
Yeah.
Like small and medium businesses that want some IP telephony, get off their old POTS phone system and get it into the cloud. And so I think it'd be huge for SMB. You know, big enterprises, they've already got this. They've already got a lot of telephony stuff already baked and done, right, obviously.
Yeah.
So it'll take them a while to move to it. But SMBs, I could see this as a total no-brainer.
Yeah, I agree. Yes, that's one big news.
Yeah. Another big piece of news is Microsoft's new Power Apps system went into preview.
Yeah, definitely. So, what's your take on this?
It's a way to build business apps for end users or power users in a drag and drop style, and run it in the cloud without having to write code.
And also work on mobile.
That's right. So, if you're familiar with Project Sienna that Microsoft did in the past, that was the ability to build apps for Windows, you know, touch-friendly apps and things like that, and deploy them. And this is kind of an evolution of that. So it includes the ability to go and drag-and-drop style build a mobile application for iOS, Android, and Windows without writing code, connect it to services and APIs and things like that, and deploy it out to those devices. And it all runs, the back end of it all runs in Azure, but a lot of it's all sort of abstracted away from you, from having to worry about. And they're pitching it as a way to, you know, for power and business users to build business apps that target mobile devices. Now, the interesting thing is you don't get an app package that you deploy. They have a player application that you have to run on iOS, Android, and Windows that you install first. So you open that app and then it shows you your apps. So it's more of a player type experience than a, you know, spitting out an actual app itself that you have to go deploy.
Yeah, it's an interesting approach. It's, I guess, first thing that people saw are sort of saying with this, especially those from the SharePoint background, is they're looking at it to say, is this an InfoPath replacement?
No.
And I don't think it's an InfoPath replacement at all.
No, I can see why people would think that, because it's kind of a form builder, right? You can build forms in it. But if you, it's not an InfoPath replacement yet. It's far from it.
Yeah.
There's no web experience, for example. You can't use these apps in a web browser just yet. It's mobile only, right? You can't use them to do things like workflow initiation or task forms or anything like that you could do with InfoPath. It can't replace your list forms just yet, like in a SharePoint context. There's a lot of scenarios that InfoPath covers today that Power Apps don't cover. But what it does cover is the ability to deploy, say, a very basic business type application out to your users on mobile devices in a fairly straightforward way. Now, whether businesses will pick up on this is up for debate. Well, I guess we will see. The jury's out. But it's an interesting initiative, and it's a pretty nice experience. I don't know if you've played with it much recently, but it's out in preview, and you can sign up to get on the preview, and it's pretty straightforward and intuitive. This has been a long time coming.
I
worked on a bit of this while I was at Microsoft, and it's nice to see it come to fruition.
Yeah, I got a nice little preview of this a couple of weeks ago, and it's an impressive little tool. It's an impressive app builder. I think that especially the people who are looking at it coming from a SharePoint background need to be careful about what your expectations are.
Absolutely.
I think if you look at it as a little app builder, to be able to pull data from different places and mash up and think about it like that, it is very, they've done a really good job with it. But if you're looking at it from the context of like an InfoPath replacement, you're really going to be disappointed, because that's not what it's targeted to. We'll see where they go with it. But so far, it's interesting. I do think that this whole marketing spin that they put out when it was announced, saying this is Microsoft's next billion-dollar idea, I was like, you really think it's that? I mean, I don't know.
I'm going to be cheeky and read between the lines. I think they want it to be Microsoft's next billion-dollar idea, but probably not for the reasons people think.
Yeah.
What they really want it to do is drive Azure consumption, and that might be $1 billion. Who knows?
Yeah, I can see that. totally see that.
So yeah, that's Power Apps.
Okay, so that's our little bit of news here. Do we have anything else we want to cover?
No, I think those are the biggies.
Yeah, we got a couple other things we've thrown into Flipboard. But hey, one of the things you threw into Flipboard was Microsoft's plans to add containers to Windows client. So instead of talking about that, why don't we just talk about what this whole container thing is all about?
Yeah, let's do that. We've been being given crap on Twitter about this. We've had emails sent to us about talking about Docker and containerization and things like that. So we've put it off long enough, AC.
I think so. So I know we had a nice little dialogue with a gentleman on Twitter, and I know we've talked about it a little bit on the show. I think that what we want to do in this one, because I think that this really could be a multi-part discussion.
Yeah.
And so instead of trying to boil the ocean here, which I know that, you know, one guy was talking about asking us, but talk about in the context of like medical devices or medical services and stuff like that. Let's just talk about generally what this stuff is. And because I know that when I first started getting into it, that it was a bit of a mythical kind of thing. I mean, I'd hear people talk about it at Build. And it wasn't really something that I really understood what was going on. So
I definitely have found that I really, you know, much like anything, this shouldn't come as a surprise to me, but it does. You think you understand it and then you play around with it or play around with, learn more about it as you play with it. And it suddenly becomes a whole lot clearer. So hopefully we'll be able to share with some listeners and demystify it a little.
Yeah. So here's how we're going to do this. We're going to start with a little bit of an introduction. We'll talk about where you can go to get some information about it, where you can learn some stuff, the resources you and I have used, why it's interesting, what's interesting about it, or what's appealing to it for different projects, where it makes sense. And then we'll go with like some more advanced stuff. And from there, really like to get some feedback from you guys on what you'd like to know about it, what things weren't clear, what things, you know, people you'd like to talk to. There's a few people I'd like to bring on the show to talk about it, but we're going to give it a stab ourselves. So I'm going to kind of treat it a little bit like an interview thing where I'm going to ask you a couple of questions and we'll just have a little bit of a discussion here. So let me first start off with the real general thing is, CJ, I've heard this stuff about virtual machines, and I think that all of our audience understands this concept of IaaS, or infrastructure as a service and virtual machines. So what the hell is this concept of a container, and is it just a virtual machine?
Yeah, that's a really good question, right? Because it's kind of in this weird gray area that nobody really knows what to call, and now I think we've got a name for it, which is containerization, which is, we're familiar with IaaS, which is running virtual machines like Windows or Linux or something like that in a completely, completely isolated and virtualized environment, right? So you spin up a number of virtual machines and you can go use them and run apps inside those virtual machines. On the flip side, and where Azure started was with PaaS, so platform as a service. And basically the other end of the spectrum is Azure will take care of running your app. You just deploy your app and they'll go run it for you. And you don't have to worry about the underlying operating system or feeding and watering it and all that sort of stuff. And where containers sit is between those two. So at least this is the way I visualize it, right? Is there's this happy little medium ground between those two where you can build and package an application and run it with some more of the power of virtual machines, with fewer of the cons of virtual machines, but with some of the pros of PaaS and with fewer of the cons of PaaS. So it's kind of a bit of a meld between those two.
Okay, so let's kind of break this down a little bit then. So it's not, so you should not think of it, I kind of hear two things here, right? And this is the part where I got confused. I should think about it like a virtual machine, but don't think about it like a virtual machine. It's a lightweight version of it.
I think thinking of it as a virtual machine is not a bad thing. It's just an extraordinarily lightweight virtualized environment.
So when you say that, the part that I thought that really helped me with this is that, you know, when you have a virtual machine, you have an operating system inside the virtual machine. It really is a virtualized computer inside of some physical host. The difference with containers, though, is that while they have some characteristics of a virtual machine, for example, you allocate the processor, you allocate the RAM, you allocate you also can expose like the networking, the ports that are available to it and everything. You can do all that kind of stuff. But what you don't have is you don't have an operating system inside this container. Instead, it uses the operating system from the host. So much so that when you look at how long it takes to spin up a virtual machine and you compare that to how long it takes to spin up a container, it's radically different. For example, you take an average VM, it's going to take, what, a minute, 2 or 3 minutes to go through and boot up?
Yeah.
In a container, I wouldn't even call it booting up a container. It's really spinning up a container, almost turning it on, because these things turn on a measure of milliseconds. I mean, you can have a container up and running with a website in it in literally about 2 seconds.
So think about it. So the way I've thought about this, right, is, you know, when you've got running a full virtual machine, it doesn't matter if it's Linux or Windows, you give it a CPU and you give it some memory and it runs the OS, right? And that CPU and memory is just virtual, right? It's from the host that's running the virtual machine. But if you take that a step further and say, the operating system is also from the host, that's kind of the next step towards containers, right? You're not just sharing CPU and memory, but you're also sharing underlying operating system in a isolated, secure, and manageable way, right? So things inside the container can't just randomly write stuff all over your host and get access to processes that it shouldn't. But it's kind of like virtualized memory, but it's a virtualized OS from the host.
Yeah, heavily sandboxed.
Heavily sandboxed, right? And what this means is, you know, in a virtual machine, you could run on Hyper-V on Windows Server, you could run a Linux box, right? In the container world, you can't do that. Your container, say you are running an Ubuntu Linux container, has to be running on a Linux host, and so it's because it shares the OS, right? So you're not completely abstracted away from the underlying host. That's where I'm getting at with that. And Windows are working on containerization technology in Windows Server, which will mean that you can run Windows containers as well. I think, but that is still a work in progress.
Yeah, was it Windows Server 2016 Preview 2 is where that was, the support was first added for that.
Gotcha.
And so there's still, it's available to play with, but it's not available, it's not fully fleshed out yet. It's still not a release candidate or anything, but it's supposed to be in the next version of Windows Server.
The nice bit about the virtualization of the OS is that you know, you said booting, right? Normally, you boot a virtual machine; it can take a few minutes, right? And booting a container is literally milliseconds. It's really just, you know, spinning it up and away you go.
Yeah.
So it's very quick.
So when I first started getting into this, the part that I thought was one of the things that had a little bit of a challenge in wrapping my brain around is, like, you know, what do I need to be able to kind of get started with this? I know the developers that are listening to this are going to be like, well, let me play with this. What's involved with this? And this helped me understand it a bit. And so I know there's a couple different container technologies that are out there. The leading one, at least from where I sit, the leading one is a company by the name of Docker. And they're standardizing their container technology with other companies that are out there. But for the most part, Docker is the one that you really kind of look to for this. It's like when you think Linux, I mean, when you think container, we're going to talk about it in the context of Docker. So how do I go through and actually like deal with this stuff? How do I play with it today? And today, I mean, let's not talk about where the preview world where Microsoft is going is that where do your containers actually run? How do you get these things to run? So you can get this to run on top of if you have a PC with Windows running, if you have an OS X laptop, you know, MacBook Pro, if you've got a Linux machine, if you want to run this in AWS or in Azure, it all kind of boils down to you're going to have a host for your containers. And that is generally a virtual machine.
On a client machine, so like your client, your desktop Windows box or your desktop OS X OS X box, you'll probably end up spinning up a virtual machine to run all your containers in. But then in the cloud, obviously, so say you were doing it in Azure, you'd spin up a bunch of VMs to run your containers in up there.
And these VMs, because today Windows is not fully container, does support fully containers, or does not fully support containers and Docker yet, you're spinning up Linux machines.
Correct. Yep. Something like Ubuntu or Debian or something like that to run them.
Yeah. And so what do you need? Once you've done that, what do you then need to get it to host a container on that machine?
Well, so the best way to get started is if you go up on docker.com and there's a big orange Get Started button. Docker have recently come out with a thing called Docker Toolbox, which is basically a 5 or 6 step guided process with all of the right install to get So on OS X, for example, it downloads VirtualBox and gets a VM up and running with all of the things you need in it and all the command line tools and all that sort of stuff that you need to get started to run containers in that VM, for, you know, setting up your dev box,
yeah,
that sort of thing. So that's definitely the easiest. It's a very straightforward process and easy to get up and running on a client box, either Windows or OS X.
Yeah, and so for those people who are not familiar with what VirtualBox is, that is, we've got Hyper-V as Microsoft's virtualization offering. You've got the offering from VMware, which is either Workstation or Fusion. The one from Oracle is VirtualBox, and VirtualBox is a free virtualization thing. So, and it's cross-platform. So Docker leverages, uses VirtualBox, it downloads VirtualBox, installs it on your machine, and then walks you through the process of creating a single Linux-based VM on VirtualBox. You spin that up, and then you have to install the Docker engine on that VM.
Yeah, and that's the Docker toolbox will do all of that for you and get the VM up and running, so you don't have to worry about installing things in there or going through the install of Linux. There's pre-built images that it pulls down and uses.
Yeah, and it's pretty darn impressive, too. The getting started thing, my experience when I went through this, I thought in maybe about an hour max or something like that, somewhere around an hour. And this is using a hotel internet connection. I did this actually. I had to stay in Redmond the week between, or Bellevue, the week between the MVP summit and the following week for some business. And I remember on Sunday morning, just before I even finished my second cup of coffee, was able to pull this stuff down, get everything up and running on my my MacBook Pro and get my first container running. It was very simple, very straightforward, and very, very easy. That helped me really understand how this stuff really worked.
Yeah, the getting started walkthrough is pretty easy to follow, and you'll get your first container up and running in no time.
Okay. So now let's talk a little bit about the kinds of applications that you would actually create with this. Where does this make sense? What kinds of scenarios does using something like containers, where does this make sense? One of the things that I've heard about with this is that, you know, you think about it in the concept of you're not building like these monolithic applications. You can, but you're not really building monolithic applications in containers. You're really virtualizing the applications. You're not really, unlike virtualizing the host machine. So when I hear that, I was like, oh, okay, well then what does that mean? What kind of applications would I be building here? So what would you say if someone said, you know, what kind of scenarios does this make sense?
Yeah. Well, like, why would you even look at this? Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think for me, so to give a little bit of background, at Hyperfish, we're building all of our stuff containered. So we're taking the plunge and building all of the web and back-end API components of our apps are all going to be containerized. And the reason we chose to do that there's two primary things. One is running the stuff in production and the benefits that go along with that, and which I'll talk about in a second. And then the other is developer productivity. So addressing each of those in turn, right? So on the production side, containerization gives you a few things. It gives you the ability to deploy and manage your application in pretty straightforward manner. So being able to roll out new versions of your application, tear down containers and spinning up containers is very straightforward in comparison to having to roll out new VM images, patching and managing VMs, spinning them up, spinning them down, the time that takes and all those sorts of things. Managing it at a container level is much more straightforward. The second thing is like environment consistencies. So we know that between our dev box, our stage environment, and our production environment, that they're all identical. Like the runtimes are all identical. So when you spin up a container on your dev box, it is the exact same environment that you'll see when that application runs in production. And so it's from a developer fixing a bug in production, for example, we know we're able to replicate those environments really straightforwardly. And then the third thing on the production side is scale. So if we become super popular, then we want to be able to scale our app really, really easily. And doing that with containers is much more flexible. Being able to spin up more containers across more hosts and spin them down as demand requires. And you can do that in a much more managed and virtualized manner than you can with, it's all possible with virtual machines, of course, and lots of people do it that way, but I think it's much more straightforward in a container.
Yeah, so there's two things here that I kind of wanted to, I wanted to kind of dive in a little bit on, refuse to use the term double click, but there's two things I kind of wanted to kind of dive in here on to talk a little bit more about. So one thing you talked about was being able to very easily update, roll out, fit, do patches and stuff like that. And I think that the, one of the reasons it's like this is because one of the architecture models that that containers really are suited for is this concept of microservices.
Yeah.
And so when I say that, when I say microservices, I mean, you're not building this monolithic component that, or this big component within your application. Let's say you're building, you know, some very big piece of some very big application. You don't have like three or four major, major components within your application. You have lots of little ones. And so you've got your app is built into lots of little different pieces. And so it's easy to go update one of those pieces.
Yeah.
One of the things that this does kind of, this architectural model does kind of go along with is it is heavily leveraged on this concept of messaging and being able to using queues and stuff to where everything communicates with each other in a very asynchronous, in a very
decoupled way,
decoupled, very loosely coupled way. So everything just kind of spins up and they talk to each other. It's not that one sends a message to one container and waits for him to respond. It's more that they talk through some sort of a broker in between. So they're going to maybe write a message over to a service bus topic or some sort of a pub sub topic that other containers are listening for, and then they get notified that, hey, there's something there. They either get the message or they go listen, they go look at a queue to figure out what needs to be done.
Yeah, I mean, those things are not, you know, Docker or container specific, right? That's just building a highly scalable distributed application. But where Docker and containers step in is it makes it really easy to run each of those little components and pieces.
Yeah, and scale them each individually.
Correct, yeah. Right.
So, for example,
in our case, we have a front-end web application, which is a standalone app, and we have a back-end API, right? And so each of those are going to run in different containers and can be scaled differently. And then behind the API application, there's a number of other components that can be scaled independently of one another.
Like little worker jobs. So if you had something that was like processing a queue, you could have one container that was running all the time that was watching the queue and say, No, it is, you've got one or two containers running. Let's say you have one container that you built and his job is to process items on the queue. And so he's just constantly saying, let me take one item off the queue, do some work with it, take it off the queue. Let me move on to the next one and the next one. If everything's running just fine, your system is doing just fine, then there's nothing to really change there. But maybe you have this like little scheduling piece or this little monitoring container, and his job is to watch the queue and to watch how big the queue gets. And let's say all of a sudden that you get this spike of traffic. And so now this queue has now of jobs that need to be run, processed, is now getting bigger and bigger and bigger because the one container that's running can't simply keep up with the amount of work that's coming in. So what that little scheduler could do is he could go tell, using the API and Docker, he could actually reach out and say, hey, go spin up four more instances of that container so that now I've got a pool of four different workers from that one container. I have four different containers, instances of it running, and they're all processing and working on the queue. And when the queue starts to get farther, when it starts to get in a more manageable state, that little monitoring process can say, all right, let's go scale it back, go tear down two or three of those guys. They don't need to keep running.
Correct. Yeah. And just, but the speed at which you can do that is very different from with virtual machines because the overhead of spinning them up is very low. And so you can literally fire them up in less than a second and have another container processing your queue.
Well, and one of the other things it does too is that, you know, we looked at another way that you can look at this is look at the, think about like processing or application density on a host. So when you look at a normal, like when you build out virtual machines today, if you're doing it in the cloud, if you're doing it in a data center, then yeah, you want to make sure you can get as many virtual machines on a host that you can. So the host is constantly, is not fully maxed out, but it's, let's say, 80 or 90% of its capacity. And all the VMs are running in a nice stable state. But let's say the VMs that are running, they're only running at about, you know, say 20 or 30% of what their capacity is. So you're still losing a little bit of efficiency in there. One of the things that containers is going to allow you to do too is because they're generally smaller processes and not these big virtual machines, you're going to have the ability to force to pack more of these instances of these containers that are running inside the same host to get a much higher density and not be able to need nearly as much infrastructure to run these things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because you're not dedicating, say, 4 gig of RAM to a virtual machine or a container, right? You're spinning them up and allocating resources, but it's all shared. So you're not tying it up on a process that might not be using it.
Okay, cool. So let me ask you another question then. So We've been using this. We've been throwing around two terms here: containers and instances.
Yeah,
a little bit, or images. What does the story look like in the sense of, am I? Let's say I'm building something, and let's just talk about the static way of doing it. Let's not go like detail and like automation and all that kind of stuff. Although there's a great story for that, and we'll try to get into that this show. If not, then that's would be a fantastic second part of the show.
Yeah.
But let's say I'm building some. Let's say I'm building a website, right? And let's say I'm building a website. It's a little simple Node.js website once, or it's a cross-platform ASP.NET website Microsoft is working on. Or, once we get the Windows support for this, we can do classic ASP.NET MVC apps. Once I'm building something, I'm building a site, and I'm testing it runs just fine on my machine. So first question, couple questions here. Let's kind of do like rapid fire stuff. First question is, how do I quote unquote Dockerize that app? What makes that a Docker container? I mean, how much do I have to build my app and my website in a totally different way to be able to have it work inside of a container?
No. So basically this boils down to a couple of simple steps. You build, say you had a Node app that fired up a page that said, hello world, right? Most basic scenario.
Yep.
To get that guy running in a container, all you need to do is define a few parameters about your container. And what in the Docker world, this is called building a Docker image, right? The terminology is you build an image, much like you'd build a project, mm-hmm. and then you use those images to spin up containers. So you say, I want 5 containers running that image.
Okay, right? So it's like a template.
It is. It's like a template. Okay. And so there's in your project, you drop an additional file called a Docker file.
Oh, go figure.
Yeah, which is basically a text file, which defines a few things about your project. So it says things like, what underlying image do you want to start from? So for example, in a Node application, you might want to start from a pre-built Node image that already has the Node runtime already defined in it and packaged in it and things like that. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to start from Ubuntu and then add Node and add all of your other things. Docker has a thing called Docker Hub, which is a place where images are published for people to use.
It's like a public registry.
Exactly, yeah. So there's already a Node image, an official Node image published in Docker Hub that you can start from.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't have to build that up yourself. So basically you say, in your Docker file, you say what you want your image to be based on with the from command. And then it's basically a set of execution instructions to say, what do you want to do next? And you might want to add your project files to that image. So you'd say add, and then a path with your files and where you want to put it in the image. And then what commands you want to run inside that image. So it might be installing gulp, it might be installing nodemon, it might be installing TSD, it might be installing a bunch of those kinds of things inside your image. And those are just command execution lines in that Docker file. And then once you're done with that, that defines how you want your image to be built. And then on the command line, you can say docker build, and it'll use your Docker file to go and grab that node image from Docker Hub, execute the commands that you've defined in your Docker file to do things like the install of your application files and stuff like that. And then it drops a Docker image on your machine.
On your local machine.
Yep, on your local machine. And actually, this is kind of interesting about Docker. So the way the images are built up are sort of like diff disks from one another, or differentials, binary diffs from one another. So for example, your Node application image might only be a couple of megabytes in size because it's just a diff of what you've added to the base Node image that you got from Docker Hub. So you're not having to deal with these images like VMs, which are, multiple gigabytes in size, like 20, 30, 40 gigs in size for a big VM. You're just dealing with the Docker image, which is the diff of the underlying one that you've based yours on, which in turn could be a diff based on something else, on something else, on something else, right? So it's these chained diffs that build up your image over time.
Okay, so now I've got this image that I've then created. It's sitting there on my laptop, right?
Yep.
And let's say I want to use this somewhere. I want to make this available to my production application. So yep. Then I take that image and what do I do? Do I then take that image and do I upload it to my virtual machine, to my hosts up in Azure, or do I give it to my ops guys and say, go put this on our Linux machines that are running Docker?
Yeah, well, first thing you want to do is run it.
Oh, that's true. You want to try it, make sure it works.
Test your image, right? And, yeah. And in actual fact, we're moving to doing all of our development in a containerized model as well. So we don't even run and develop our apps on our local box anymore. We develop in a container, but we'll get into that in another show.
Yeah, that would be a cool show. Is how does Docker help development? But
yeah.
So you're building your images. You're running them all locally inside of the VirtualBox host on your laptops to be able to test it all. But that way, you know that if you get a new dev, they run down to the store, buy a new laptop, install VirtualBox, install the Linux VM, and install the Docker engine, and then they just say, I want to go start up the app, and just it pulls everything down that it needs from all the different images, and it's all good.
Exactly. And you know that you're developing in an environment that matches what's going to be in prod.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, I said something there, and I wanted to make sure that we clarify this too, that I said you're going to just pull down all the stuff that you need and go run it. But what we've been talking about so far with images was that I have to give you the image to go run the image. But
yeah.
One of the things that Docker does, or Docker Hub does, is it allows you to create an account, and you can publish your image to Docker Hub under your account.
Right.
So that what you can do is that, let's say you go to Azure and you spin up four or five different Ubuntu hosts that have Docker installed in them. And you say, I want to go create these containers on, or create instances of that container on, sorry, containers, which are instances of that image. I want to run them on these different hosts. What Docker does is it goes out to Docker Hub to go get that image and pulls it down the first time you say, go create a new container based on this image.
Exactly. Yeah. So your images, you can distribute your images in what in Docker terminology is called an image repository, right? So you go, there's a public image repository, which is hub.docker.com, which is where a whole bunch of public images, like that node one that I mentioned, are published. But you can also create private repositories, which are for your own images that you don't want to distribute publicly, but you just want to distribute for your business or your organization or what have you.
Yeah.
So you go publish. It's very much like pushing a Git repo. So on the command line in Docker, it's like Docker push, and you can push a particular image to a location. And one example of that would be a private repository in Docker Hub.
Mm. Okay.
But there's other options for that.
Cool. Well, okay. So let's do that. I think we've gone through and talked about this now for about 40, 45 minutes or something like that. So we can go into a lot more depth on this whole thing real quick here. So before I dive into this, I was going to say, here are a couple other things that we've kind of uncovered that we think are really cool about this, and we could go along with additional episodes, but I kind of want to hear from the listeners and find out what they're interested in where we go with this. So I know one of them, we said, you know, how does it benefit the developer side? But let me ask you this. You've alluded to a few things here, but I'll let you do this first and then I'll do it. But what to you is interesting/appealing to this technology for your organization? I mean, you guys, you're a startup, you're an incubator, you're building a bunch of products. You guys are betting the farm, saying this is the way we're going to go with this whole thing. What is causing you to do that? What is the appeal in Docker for this?
I would say it boils down to productivity. We want to be able to build technical productivity, really, right? We want to be able to develop, build, deploy, and run applications with as few people as possible. And so for us, doing it in containers with a boatload of automation helps us do that. So for example, when a developer checks a piece of code in or commits a piece of code, we have it so that that goes into GitHub. It gets pulled from GitHub by a system called Travis, which is a continuous integration system. It builds the code and tests it. It then automatically creates the Docker image if the build passes.
All the tests pass, right?
Yeah, this is at each step, but only if it succeeds. So it takes the built application, packages it as a Docker image, then pushes that Docker image to a private repository in Docker Hub. And then we use a system called Tutum from Docker, which gets triggered when a image gets published or a new image gets published to Docker Hub, pulls that image and then redeploys our integration environment automatically with that Docker image or set of Docker images. Right, so we can go from a developer checking, you know, a simple string fix or adding a piece of functionality to our application on their client machine, all the way through to deployment in our integration and test environments with zero manual intervention.
And be able to replicate the entire environment down on their local machines because it's all living up in those VMs, it's living inside your private repository. The images that were rebuilt when they got the notification from Travis and pulling the updates from GitHub.
Yeah, so imagine if your app, you know, running it all locally is really important because you think, well, running a basic Hello World app in Node on your local machine is no big deal, and you'd be right, except when you're building highly scalable and distributed apps, you've got things like databases to consider, caches to consider, message buses and queues to consider, like maybe 5, 10, 15, 20 different components of your application to consider, all using a variety of different technologies and different bits and pieces. And trying to set all that up on your local dev box is an absolute nightmare. But if it's all containerized, you can spin up 5, 10, 15, 20 different containers on your local dev box and have them all talk to each other, no problem at all.
Yeah, a matter of seconds.
And you can run it all in a very isolated manner and isolated to the developer as well, so that they've got a full environment running on their machine.
Mm. So that automation piece that you were just talking about there, that was one of the things that I was going to try and entice from you to get people to say, is that something you'd like to hear more about? Because that's one of the things that I thought has been really appealing to this to me as well, is that just the automation piece of being able to go from code check-in and then watching it flow all the way through up to an integration environment or all the way out to a staging environment, then be able to manually hit the switch and say, no, I want this to be my production environment. That was one of the things that I thought was really interesting about it. The other thing that I thought was really appealing to it was just the ability to build small components. I'm the kind of developer that is terrified to roll out updates to a production system. If the system's working, even if there's a bug fix, I'm scared to fix the bug because I'm afraid of what it's going to impact. And when everything is small components and it's all based on this single responsibility principle, then I know that when I roll one update out, I know I'm just impacting that one piece and that everything is still going to be calling that piece. But I know that one piece, it's less of a chance of me breaking something because it wasn't so impactful to the rest of the application.
And if you do break it, you just tear down those containers and you stand back up the previous version.
Yeah, you can revert back to the previous ones.
Yeah, they're all of the images are tagged. You can tag them however you like. Most people tag them with a version number as well as other information. And so you can just, you know, say you want to roll back and spin up the old version of the image.
Mm. So let me ask you this then, as we're kind of coming up on our time here. I guess I that was one of the questions I wanted to ask you was what was interesting, what was appealing to it for you. I know a lot of the same stuff is appealing to me. I like the ability. I like the concept of working in these smaller components. I like the lightweight characteristics of containers and being able to spin this stuff up. I like the fact that it's incredibly portable to work both on my laptop the same way it works up in Azure, the same way it works over, say, in AWS or really anywhere. It doesn't even matter where you want to run this stuff. It'll be really interesting to see. I've kind of heard rumors about this. No NDA stuff here, but I've heard rumors about how, you know, that we may have like a container service in Azure so that you don't have to go manage the creation of the different Linux hosts. I could just say, look, I need 50 containers. Go run these guys. I don't care what host they're on. You, Azure, you worry about all that stuff.
Yeah. So this is an interesting piece I've been doing, we're doing all of this on Azure. But you could do it on AWS or you could do it on whatever cloud service you want. But doing it raw on Azure, it's a bit of a nightmare. So, and by that I mean, you really don't want to be going in there into Azure and having to spin up virtual machines on your own and configure them with Docker and get your swarm going and all that, or a cluster of Docker nodes running and all of that. You really want to use a piece of software that helps you do that. And in our case, we're using Tutum, which was recently bought by Docker, which helps you stand up those nodes, manage your cluster, and deploy containers to them. Trying to do that manually, I started doing that, and it's all possible, but it's quite a bit more work. And eventually, you know, Azure will probably, I don't know, but I imagine will have a way of doing that on its own. But we're using Tudum, which works against AWS, it works against Azure, it works against
Heroku,
which there's a few different services it works against. And what it does is it basically takes over your Azure subscription or has access to your Azure subscription and can create virtual machines for you and configure them correctly with all the right port mappings and all of that sort of stuff. And so that when you deploy when you want to spin up a container and deploy based off an image, it can take care of deploying it to those nodes for you and get it up and running.
And it makes sure that when you create those, like there's a concept that we didn't really go into. You alluded to it, something called a swarm. So it's basically saying, once I have like five of these different Linux VMs that are all going to act as hosts for my Docker containers, you then have one place where you install this thing called Swarm, and all the different hosts register themselves with Swarm. And Swarm is kind of like the load balancer that says, hey, I talk to Swarm and say, go create 50 different containers. And it looks at all the machines that are out there and it starts creating the instances of the containers on those different hosts for you. That's the part that Tutan's going to go through and automate and make a little bit simpler from the management process for you. And that's got a whole bunch of APIs that you can use to say, I need more instances, more images. It makes this process of creating and adding hosts to your load balancers and to your scale a lot easier, a lot simpler, and a lot less manual.
Yeah. So Swarm is one option for managing your cluster of nodes. Tudum, I don't believe, actually uses Swarm, but it does a similar kind of thing.
Yeah.
There's a few different options. Then there's things like Mesos and all that sort of stuff for managing your cluster of nodes and deploying containers based on all sorts of different rules and resource usage and availability rules and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, you basically, the short story is you want to use a piece of software that helps you manage your cluster.
It's going to be interesting to see how this evolves too, because I know that this is a very hot technology. I know it's one that Azure is very keen to adopt and take advantage of and expose to developers and to their customers. I mean, it was a big talking point for both, not only at the recent Connect event, but also at the AzureCon event and back at Build. I know that Mark Rusinovich was talking a lot about it at Build.
At the moment, for example, there is a Docker template for Azure Resource Manager that lets you spin up a swarm in a Docker swarm in Azure of virtual machines and things like that. But if you want to fiddle about with, I don't know if you've ever looked at Azure Resource Manager templates, but they can get quite complicated, they're XML files and they can get quite large. You go take a look at the quick start templates and go take a look at the Docker one. It's pretty complicated and fiddling around with that is hard. So it wouldn't surprise me if in Azure we see a simple wizard to be able to say, I want a Docker swarm, this many nodes, go. And it just presses it out for you.
With an auto scale capability, the same way we have with like VMs and websites and stuff like that.
Correct. Yeah.
So, okay, we've touched on a bunch of different things. I think people can definitely, if you're interested in hearing more about this, you know, please reach out to us. Let us know what you're interested in. Either hit us up on Twitter at MS Cloud Show or just go to the website, leave a comment on the show notes. We get those and we'd love to talk more about this kind of stuff. I know you and I are both knee deep in this technology right now. You, especially me, for a project that's coming up. But one thing then I wanted to ask you then is, where did you go? Where did you find some of the best kind of getting started and learning resources that were out there? What were your favorite ones? I've got a few that I did, and I'm curious to see where you went.
Yeah. So the first thing is that getting started experience on Docker, on docker.com. So that's the first thing I did. I ran through, got my local dev box set up, and ran through the quick start sort of tutorials that they had there, and that got me up and running with my first very basic Hello World type container. Mm. Pluralsight has some good courses on it. There's some folks. There's some good tutorials on the Tudum website, and Tudum you spell Tutum, so it's Tutum.co is their website, not .com. .com is a totally different website.
Yeah.
But .co. And Tudum has some good tutorials about how to get started on that. But from an underlying how Docker works, there's a really good course on Pluralsight that I sort of skipped a bunch through, where it talks about how all the disk differencing and all that sort of stuff works. getting started got you up and running. And then really it was, yeah, a bunch of articles on the web.
Yeah, just playing around. Yeah, it's the same with me. I mean, the Docker site, the getting started was super helpful. There's a guy, there's a specific guy on Pluralsight that I would go look for his courses. His name is Nigel Paulton. He's got one called Docker Deep Dive. He's got one first look on native Docker clustering that did a really good job of talking about, you know, setting up a swarm. And then he has another one on automation with Docker. And that's the one that goes into even walking you through from creating a little Node.js website, quote unquote, Dockerizing it, creating the image, publishing the image, doing a push up to Git, running it through Travis, or I think he did CircleCI, same thing. Or sorry, same concept, same type of thing.
Yeah.
Once it went through a green build, it then notified Docker. Docker's automation build created the image, notified Tooten. Tooten then went through, grabbed that, spun up a few VMs. He used AWS for this, but you can see Azure is definitely the option there. I found that to be super helpful. There's a few other courses that I found that are a lot of articles out that are out there on, you know, how they did it for development and stuff.
I just put one in our Flipboard, which was called ASP.NET 5, Continuous Integration with Travis CI, Tudum, Docker, Webhooks, and Azure. Ooh. And so it goes through completely end-to-end on building a very basic cross-platform ASP.NET 5 application, Dockerizing it, putting it into an image, pushing it up to Docker Hub, I believe. Yep, pushing it up to Docker Hub, using Tudum to deploy containers automagically into Azure.
Oh,
so
dude,
that's a really nice one to follow. And the same flow goes for any sort of technology, whether it be Node or Python or ASP.NET. So for a web application, at least, anyway.
Yeah, the other thing that I'll throw out there with this is that, you know, I know developers maybe look at this and say, God, I got to, you know, this is a lot to bite off, and it's, you know, a different way of doing things.
It's not as complex as it sounds.
It really isn't. I think that the complexity piece to it really comes down to the automation, really comes down to just how all the different pieces kind of flow together. I mean, one thing that you do see with this is that I see lots of different players or different actors involved in the automation thing. You heard us use Docker, you heard us say Tooten, you heard us say Travis, and use GitHub and all these different things and Azure. This is where I think that someone like an Azure, they have a pretty good track record for really giving a good story, like start to finish all the way through this.
Simplifying it down.
Yeah. So I think they do a good job with it. What I found with this, though, in the little bit that I play with it, you're not building your application in a Docker way. You're really following the same concept that's been around for a while, using a service-oriented architecture, building smaller components that talk to each other in a decoupled way. It's nothing new there. The only part that's new is the way that they're hosted and deployed. And I think that Docker makes it easier to implement one of those kinds of deployments.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool.
SOA never went away.
No, never went.
People stopped saying the acronym for a while.
Yeah, it's just got a new name, a new label to it.
Exactly. Microservices, baby.
Cool. All right. So anything that you want to throw out there that we didn't touch on? Do you think I think we did a pretty good job of doing a good overview intro and answered some questions for some folks.
Yeah. I think I just want to reiterate, it's not as complex as it sounds. It's a little bit of a mind meld for, you know, the first couple of hours. But I would say probably in, you know, 1 to 4 hours, you can be building an app using Docker and starting to experience and learn why some of these things are so appealing. And like I said, not as complex as it sounds.
Yeah, the ramp up, I agree with you. The key thing there is you said hours. I was really surprised. I kept hearing about Docker for the last year and a half. I thought I understood it conceptually until I really got into it. It was totally glassed over when I was watching the keynote at Build on this piece. I tried to understand it. I was like, I'm just not getting it. I'm not getting it. Sitting down to that getting started, spending about 2 hours. For me, it was about two and a half hours of going through the getting started, seeing it run, watching those two courses on Pluralsight by Nigel, which is about an hour a piece, two or three courses by him. And it felt like the ramp up was very quick, very, very, I was able to be productive really fast. But then from there, you start to see tons of options of other ways you can go with it, with the automation and the scaling and everything. And it's really, really cool. I thought it was really, really cool. So, So to everybody that was listening, let us know what you thought about this. Let us know if you want to hear more about it. If you do, what kinds of things you're interested in. And, Yeah, we just kind of go from there. And I think that we can also just let everybody know that we are going to be taking a week off next week, and maybe even another one with CJ is going to be out celebrating his 40th birthday. He's getting very, very old.
Thanks, mate.
I'm only 2 months behind you, so that's the only reason I can say it like that.
I'll mock you suitably when the time comes.
Oh yeah, I'm just buttering you up for it. So anyway, you're going to be out. I know that Christmas is coming up too, so schedule's going to get kind of wacky. So
yeah, apologies for that in advance, but I'm hopeful we'll get a few episodes out over the next few weeks.
Absolutely. So cool.
Excellent. Thanks for the chat.
Yeah, man. Thank you. And again, thanks everybody for listening, and hope you got something out of this. We'll see you soon. Not next week.
Nice.
If you have a question for us, go to MicrosoftCloudShow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text. We'll record it as a WAV or an MP3 file and provide a link so that we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is an excerpt from Evaporated Eric by Monk Turner, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for the Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at MicrosoftCloudShow.com, where you'll also find a full transcript and show notes of each episode. You can find us on Facebook searching for the Microsoft Cloud Show or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.